Good morning. I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Monday, the 3rd of June. All things political coming up this hour. We have a lot to talk about. The president has been talking about student loans. Interest rates are going to double in under a month, so you're going to graduate from college with huge debt, which means that you can't buy a car, get a house, or maybe get married and have children. It seems as though it may have large ramifications. We will talk about that. Our guest, who writes for The Root, wrote a recent piece, Mr. President, Get a Handle on the Scandals. We'll continue talking about those. Healthcare in the news with the Affordable Care Act about to come into its full measure. And I don't think too many people know exactly what it will do. And also we're going to do a major story on this probably this week, but the New York Times had a major story on healthcare yesterday showing how much the United States pays for healthcare, really so much more expensive than other countries in the world. We are going to do that for a full hour tomorrow at 9, but I'd like for our guest to comment on that during the course of this hour. What is going on with the immigration bill? Is there controversy about that? We haven't talked about that for a while, so we'll look at that. Michael Bloomberg is funding efforts to pressure local politicians to enact stricter gun laws, just a few of the topics. Oh, and Eric Holder, who somewhere over the weekend I read that some in the West Wing are privately wishing that he would step down. Does our guest think that may happen? David Zwerdlich is our guest. He covers national politics for TheRoot.com, which is a part of the Washington Post digital operation, and we'll be welcoming phone calls for David as well. Here's how you reach us. Give us your thoughts on those topics or whatever you'd like to discuss. 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. Our email is talk@wpr.org, and our Facebook page is The Kathleen Dunn Show. David Zwerdlich, hello. Thanks so much for being with us, sir.
Hey, Kathleen. How are you?
I'm fine, David. How are you?
Good. Thanks for having me.
Sure. Our great pleasure. Why don't we start with this student loan story? Because a lot of students are graduating from college, and I had heard that the average student now has almost $25,000 in debt. Two-thirds of college graduates and a fifth have about $50,000. That strikes me, David, as a large amount of money. Interest rates are going to double in about a month. Is there agreement on, well, there's agreement that that shouldn't be the case, but can student loan go down at all, otherwise it's going to have huge ramifications, isn't it?
It's going to have huge ramifications. We already have a situation which, you know, your listeners certainly are familiar with, where people come out of college, they come out of grad school, and they've got tremendous amount of debt from loans they've taken out to further their education that they've been encouraged to do, and then all of a sudden your career opportunities are sort of curtailed, or at least, you know, channeled by this fact that you've got to pay off this debt, and it has all these downstream effects in terms of young professionals or people coming out of school being able to build wealth, to save, to, you know, buy homes, all of the things that coming out of the 2008 recession we've all been encouraged to do. So I think it's a problem that's recognized on both sides of the aisle. The question is, what is Congress going to do about it? The president has come out and said Congress has to act to bring down these rates, but what is Congress going to do? I'm not sure. This isn't an issue that I actually report on frequently, but I will say that I think conceptually the political problem is this. People see, whether you are a student with loans or whether you're someone who's a little further on from school and you're a homeowner, et cetera, a middle-class, mid-career person, what people see, Kathleen, is that right now and for the last few years, because the prime lending rate has been so low and because banks can borrow money at such low interest, nearly 0% interest, other lending rates like mortgages are so low, right? You're talking about in the mid threes for people with good credit to get a home loan or a refinance. Mm-hmm. So when you see that, why is it that students, people just starting out, are going to have to pay essentially double the interest rate that a homeowner, a middle-aged homeowner is going to do to refinance their home? And I think that's the troubling aspect politically for both parties.
Yeah, if we help the banks, if we help the car companies, why can't we help the students?
Exactly. And I think one thing that was challenged in Obama's first term by Republicans was this idea that the administration wanted to bring more of these loans back within the government and away from some of these private lenders. And there was pushback from Republicans who said he was sort of, this was part of the argument against Obama that he was, you know, bringing big government into an area that should have been dealt with more by the private sector. And there's an argument for that, but at the same time, again, we're asking ourselves, well, hey, like you said, Kathleen, if banks can borrow at nearly zero interest, if homeowners can borrow in the threes, why should someone who just got their master's, who doesn't own a home, who's a young person, maybe in their late 20s coming out, why do they have to pay what's going to come up to be 6.8, maybe almost 7% interest rate on a loan for education, which we told them to go get?
Right. Well, David, you understand whether or not Republicans and Democrats are getting along a little better in Washington. There seems to be agreement that it's not good for these interest rates to double in under 30 days. Do you have any kind of faith that a good bipartisan effort will be made to keep that from happening?
You know, I wouldn't speculate. I would say that because this is an issue that's not quite as ideological as some other issues facing Congress right now, like immigration, like taxes, like some of the political controversies or quote-unquote scandals that we've been talking about for weeks, this is a little less ideological, and so I hold out hope that they will at least in the short term find a compromise. Maybe they will be willing to extend the rates, the lower rates, for, you know, a few more months until a bigger budget deal is done or something along those lines. But as a long-term prospect, a long-term restructuring of how student loans are financed in this country overall, I'm not optimistic, just because it's so hard. I think you and all your listeners, right? I mean, this is what we seem to talk about when I come on, right? This really difficult impasse between what the president wants to do and what Republicans in Congress want to do.
Right. Well, let's talk about immigration. There had been high hopes, and it seemed to be on the fast track for quite some time. What is the status of the immigration bill, David?
Well, what was reported a lot in the last 2 weeks was that one sort of, maybe not happy, but possibly positive byproduct of the media's focus on Benghazi, on the AP and Fox News leak scandals, on the IRS controversy, was that below the radar, below the front page news coverage, the quote-unquote Gang of Eight senators were sort of, and also House, their corresponding colleagues in the House, were sort of hard at work hashing out some of the details of this legislation. So what would have otherwise been more fodder for cable news and so forth actually wound up kind of going on behind the scenes while these other stories took front and center stage. That doesn't mean that we're on the cusp of getting comprehensive immigration reform passed, but I do think that things are progressing to where, in my assessment, there will be something done, at least voted on, you know, this summer, definitely this year. It's the same story we've heard for the last 6 months, which is that there's an interest for President Obama to keep a campaign promise from both of his presidential campaigns to get a comprehensive immigration reform bill passed. There's an incentive for Democrats in Congress, of course, to do what Democratic constituencies generally are wanting, with the possible exception of some facets of organized labor. And there's also an incentive for Republicans because, as you know, they are trying to somehow get a larger portion of the Latino and the Asian American electorate to view them favorably, and one way to do that is via immigration legislation.
Mm-hmm. I've read that the opponents, and I'm not sure how many of them there are, give me your take on that, are worried that the legislation is weak on law enforcement. The administration would counter that this administration has really deported a huge number of people, 14 million people, and an increasing number of convicted criminals. Is there significant opposition to this law enforcement part of immigration reform?
Well, you're right. I mean, the Obama administration has deported more people than the Bush administration deported in a longer period of time. The Obama administration has aggressively policed The southern border has also aggressively policed immigration in other areas apart from our border with Mexico. But the reality is that when you're talking about we're a huge country that spans four time zones, goes across a continent, a long northern border with Canada, a long southern border with Mexico. Unless you're going to, as some people want, put up a wall across every inch of the border and police, have it armed to the teeth, you're going to have people coming back and forth primarily for the economic opportunities that come with coming back and forth across the border. To answer your question, I think that the legislators can work out what components of the bill they want in terms of what enforcement mechanisms they're going to fund. And I think there's flexibility among Democrats and Republicans in terms of how that takes shape. Where the difficulty, I think, is politically, is again in the ideology, Kathleen, mm-hmm. where one side sort of says, we're too lax and we've got to crack down. And the other side says, hey, we're a nation of immigrants. We've got to find a way to incorporate the continuing immigrant story of our country. And a lot of that is coming from Latin America. And that, I think the ideological tension is much bigger than the nuts and bolts of some senators sitting in a conference room and saying, okay, we need to fund more border patrol. We need to fund better enforcement, once people are across the border. It's one thing is that whole definition of what amnesty is, right?
Right.
Some people say that immigrants have not committed a crime. Other people say crossing the border illegally is a crime. I take the view, Kathleen, that we can grant amnesty, we can call something amnesty and still grant it. In other words, yes, it's not a felony, but yes, you are making a conscious decision to break the law when you cross any international frontier without permission. But we can also, as a society, recognize that when we have 10 to 15 undocumented immigrants in this country, we've got to do something more about it than just beef up the border patrol.
Let's move to what everybody has called the scandals. You wrote a piece, Mr. President, Get a Handle on the Scandals, just a couple weeks ago with the Benghazi flap on top of the IRS scandal. You wrote, Obama has to act now or risk an ugly second term. Has he acted?
Well, I think I wrote that article 2 weeks ago, and I think in the few days after I was writing that and others were writing that, the administration did I'd like to say they went from being on their heels to getting on the balls of their feet, right? They were just sort of laying back and thinking these things were going to blow over. And quite frankly, even though the president, in my view, has faced more media scrutiny than sometimes people think, there's this perception that Obama's had this honeymoon with the press for 4 years. I wouldn't say that's the case. I think he's been scrutinized fairly well. But I will say that they have been lucky in that some stories that could have been a bigger deal have not become a bigger deal in the president's first term. Now they're in a situation where, because the Benghazi story, the IRS story, and these security leak cases have all kind of come to a head at the same time, it's created this impression that there's some chaos in the administration, and they're having to react. My point when I wrote that was simply that, regardless of what you think about the individual issues, regardless of whether you think that there's been some kind of corruption or malfeasance in the administration, which I don't, based on the evidence we know now, I do think that the president on down has kind of made a hash out of the politics. You know, the public doesn't expect presidents or attorneys general or other highly placed people in the administration to be perfect, but they do expect them to explain their actions and acknowledge when mistakes are made. And I think initially the administration wasn't doing that. They're starting to do that now. I think the president is in better shape. We've seen in the last week, though, that Attorney General Holder is not in great shape.
Right.
Because so much of this is focused on him.
I have read that some in the West Wing have privately said that they would like for him to step down. Have you heard that?
Yeah, I've heard that, and I've seen some of that coverage. There was an article in the New York Times, I think, on Saturday where there was some aides saying that the Attorney General has not done a good job of handling the situation. And I would agree with that to a certain extent. I think I actually may have an article out later today. We'll see along these lines. And my take is essentially that, again, when you're the top level, when you're a cabinet level secretary, as the attorney general is, when you're the top minister in a department, so to speak, part of your job is the ministerial duty of deciding, you know, which cases to prosecute, which cases to investigate. But deputies and associate attorneys general can get away with just doing that. The attorney general himself or any other cabinet member themselves has to remember that they are a political appointee. They have to be able to be an effective spokesperson for the administration, for the president who they serve. And I don't think Holder has always done that. He comes across as prickly, which, you know, could just be his personality. But there's been some missteps, right? You go all the way back to one that I found to be problematic for him. 1 month after Obama took office, he gave that Black History Month speech where he said that Americans have been, from time to time, cowardly about discussing issues of race. Now, he may have had a valid point, and his comments, of course, were in context, but I don't think people expected the Attorney General 1 month in to come across with that message. And that really set a tone for a lot of these sort of media dust-ups he's had with Republicans, with press. And then when there have been a few quote-unquote scandals like Fast and Furious, which wound up being debunked to a large extent, mm-hmm. but then you come along to this Fox News case, and all of a sudden you got something that kind of sticks, like even the attorney general saying, yeah, maybe I regret prosecuting this leak case and this Fox News reporter so aggressively, and people are saying, yeah, and by the way, you know, if you had been a little more upfront with the public on some other issues, maybe people would take this more in stride. But there's a lot of spotlight on him. I don't think he's done anything corrupt or illegal, but he really has pressed the boundaries in terms of press freedom in this particular case. And because he's got a track record of controversy, he's having a hard time, getting back on message.
And the press is probably going to be a little harsher on him, don't you think? After all that's happened, they probably have a little feisty relationship right now.
Yeah, no, absolutely. I mean, the press, of course, has reported on all these scandals, but when you talk about the national media looking at one of their own being charged, although ultimately not prosecuted, being charged for being an aider and abettor in a leak conspiracy, mm-hmm. The natural reaction of reporters is to say, hey, wait a minute, that's our job, to ferret
exactly.
out.
Exactly.
So it's a tricky balance. In fairness to the administration, Kathleen, I would say probably behind closed doors, the Justice Department and the White House, they perceive that while they may have a problem with the media, they know that probably the average American is maybe a little less concerned with press freedom and a little more concerned with whether leak investigations are jeopardizing national security and jeopardizing their pursuit of terrorists. But it's a very fine line, and in this case, I don't think they walked it quite right.
David Zwerdlich is our guest for All Things Political, and we're welcoming your phone calls at this point in the show. We've just touched on a couple areas. Student loans. Some of you listening, I'm sure, are facing student loans. What would you like to see in terms of lessening that burden for those among us who are graduating from college and trying to build a life and have this huge burden, which will be with people for quite some time and maybe keep them from fashioning their own lives? The immigration bill, we can talk about that some. We can talk about the word that we're using to describe the IRS and Benghazi and the AP and Fox story. The scandals, does the president seem to have a handle on those? What about Eric Holder? Do you think that his days are numbered when you start hearing stories that some of the West Wing would kind of like for him to step down? Somebody's saying that to the press, and what does that mean? We have yet to talk about health care, which we will in full measure. I don't know if you saw the New York Times story yesterday, but it was a knockout story. It focused on colonoscopies and why they cost $6,385 in the United States and maybe a couple hundred dollars in other countries. Can you have major health care reform without looking at these costs? Why doesn't anybody look at these costs? Will somebody do that as a result of this kind of press attention on this issue? Mayor Bloomberg spending quite a bit of his money to push for stricter gun laws, and is funding grassroots organizations across the country. We will talk a little bit about that and whatever you would like. At any rate, here is how you reach us, and our phone lines are completely open. 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. Send us an email if you would like at talk@WPR.org, or you can always use our Facebook page, The Kathleen Dunn Show. David Zwerdlich covers national politics for TheRoot.com, which is a part of the Washington Post Digital, and we'd like to hear from you soon. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. For those of you who love politics, and I assume that's almost everybody listening this hour, just a heads up that Olympia Snow is going to be with us Wednesday at 10 o'clock. She was in the U.S. Congress for 34 years, a three-term senator from Maine, and elected to the State House of Representatives in 1973 at the age of 26. She's a moderate Republican. She is concerned about the lack of bipartisan work on all kinds of issues, and she is the author of Fighting for Common Ground, How We Can Fix the Stalemate in Congress. She will be joining us Wednesday at 10 o'clock. It's All Things Political this hour. David Zwerdlich, our guest, covers national politics for The Root, a part of the Washington Post Digital. Our phone number is 800-486-8655. Robert in Madison, our first caller. Hi, Robert.
Yes, hi. I'd just like to chime in of my experience of just trying to pay off in full a student loan. And we had two loans with one agency in Atlanta, Georgia, and one was, I believe they call it a subsidized, where the interest, or non-subsidized, where one where the interest accrues immediately as soon as you sign it, and one where the interest starts accruing once you graduate. And we wanted to pay off, obviously, the one that where the interest accrued from the day of inception, which, you know, was right away. And when we went to do that, it was very difficult to do. They kept wanting to put half and half to each loan so that we wouldn't be able to pay off the loan that accrued interest immediately, because it became obvious that that we were already in the year and a half. We've only had it for a year and a half, and it was a small loan, and that's why we wanted to pay it off in full. And but they made it very difficult to do that, and it was just very interesting to try to work through that process and actually determine that the loan, hopefully, as of this date, we're still not sure, but that it is fully paid off, and that they then divert funds to each one so that the loan would remain open and then actively garner interest for them.
Yeah, it shouldn't be that complicated or unfair. How much was the loan, if you don't mind my asking, Robert?
It was a $3,000 loan.
Uh-huh. David, you want to respond?
Well, no, I think that's a perfect description of you know, sort of the problem that's facing so many student loan borrowers, right? You know, you get in this situation where borrowers for student loans, which I think most people would agree are, you know, is a worthwhile investment for most people, have so many fewer options than borrowers for other types of things, for, you know, home loans, for business loans, and of course, you can't, unlike, say, a home loan, you can't discharge student loans in bankruptcy. So once you got a student loan, you got a student loan. There's forbearance, but there just aren't a lot of options. And you compare. I don't want to go to too wild of a comparison with something that's probably unrealistic to happen in a country our size with our politics, but compared to, you know, sort of the wealthiest European countries like Denmark, for instance, where the government subsidizes education for everyone. We're not going to arrive at that point in the United States, but the idea that, you know, smaller European countries like Denmark, like Sweden, are fully subsidizing the education of their young people, their up-and-coming professional class. And in our case, okay, fine, we're not subsidizing it, but we can't even keep the rates down and provide people with better forbearance options or allow people to declare bankruptcy in the worst cases, strikes me as, you know, it's problematic for the future development of our, you know, kind of younger up-and-coming professional class. No question.
No doubt about that. Thank you, Robert, so much for the call. Let's go to Diane in Milwaukee next. Hi, Diane.
Good morning. The reason insurance costs are so high here in America is because the insurance executives make a minimum of 20%, hundreds of millions of dollars in salary. And if you go to Medicare, which is a single payer, their administrative costs are about 2%, not 20%. We could cut down on insurance very much if we had single payer. And I want to know why we can give the banks loans at 1% or less, and we can't give loans to students.
Thank you, Diane, for the call. Let's move into healthcare for a moment. I'm sure you saw that New York Times story yesterday that focused on colonoscopies as an indication of all that's wrong with how much we spend for healthcare in this country. But it was an incredible article. You read it and you say, wait a second, $6,600 for a colonoscopy in the U.S. and in other industrialized countries, it can be a couple hundred dollars.
Right. No, Kathleen, definitely. I think there's a point that both conservatives and liberals would make from that same data point, right? Conservatives would say, hey, we already have a heavily subsidized system, even especially with people who have employer-mandated health care, where people frequently aren't clued in to the true costs, or maybe true isn't the wrong word, to the costs of different procedures and different tests and different doctor visits, because we pay a copay or we pay a portion of it and we don't pay the whole thing. If we do have insurance and if people knew how much these things cost, they would be more aware of how much they were being subsidized. Liberals would say something to the opposite point on the same issue, right? Liberals would say, well, wait, why is that cost so much if we know that other industrialized, advanced Western countries have the cost so much lower per procedure, per doctor visit? Why can't we do the same thing? And so then it becomes, again, that ideological question of which way do you go with it? One thing I like about the listeners on your show, Kathleen, is that they always kind of come at it from that interesting angle. And I would say that there's actually sort of a conservative argument to be made for the single-payer model that your listener was talking about. You know, this again might be something that might be a little far ahead of our politicians, but I would argue that, you know, even if you're someone who's for reducing government, reducing taxes, reducing the amount of government services in people's lives, I think libertarians would say the government should only do that which people can't do individually. Well, right now we're in a situation where people can't really pay the cost of healthcare individually unless they are, you know, at a certain income or wealth level. And for that reason, you could almost make an argument that that's one of the few things that the government should do for people is provide health insurance. Your listeners will recall that when President Obama was running in the Democratic primary in 2008, it was Hillary Clinton pushing more of the insurance mandate Medicaid model that we actually wound up with, and then Senator Obama was the one saying, well, if we had a perfect world and I could start from scratch, I'd do single payer. Mm-hmm. But since we can't, we have to do something else. What he wound up doing was pursuing that whole public option thing until that didn't get anywhere, and then he sort of jettisoned that and went with the Romney Care option, which then Republicans decided that they were against. So it's really a conundrum. Until we work out the politics, we're not going to be able to work out the math.
Unless something unforeseen happens and Democrats and Republicans are able to work swimmingly together the next 4 years of his administration, it seems to me as though the signature legislation of his entire presidency will be the Affordable Health Care Act. It's a very dramatic change in health care in this country. It will go into full measure next year. A couple questions for you. Is this settled? Why do the Republicans keep talking about repealing this bill when that is not likely to happen? And are there problems, do you think, David, in terms of implementation of this? There are some states that will not be expanding Medicaid. There is some concern that poor people will not be able to get insurance or will not go to the exchanges because they'll have to pay rent and they'll have to pay food. There is some concern that nobody really knows what's going on with this as well. You know, well, how do you get insurance?
Absolutely. Well, I do think Republicans have one point in their general opposition to what everybody now calls Obamacare, the Affordable Care Act, and that is that when you put into place this huge, admittedly unwieldy new bureaucratic apparatus where the federal government is mandating that individuals buy health insurance, where they're directing states that if they want Medicaid dollars, the states will have to participate in these mandated insurance exchanges that are part of the Affordable Care Act. There's a lot of opportunity for things to go wrong, and that, I think, is a legitimate worry. And some of whether the Affordable Care Act succeeds or fails will be based on, as people have been talking about in recent weeks, whether or not it's implemented effectively and successfully. Where I think the Republicans are expressing a bit of hypocrisy on the issue is, one, as we said, they wound up basically with Mitt Romney's plan on a national scale,
right.
which Republicans arguably would have supported if it had been proposed by a President Mitt Romney. The other place where I think Republicans have only themselves to blame is that if they hadn't, back in 2009, if they hadn't sat in on their hands and refused to participate in or vote for or contribute to in any way the development of the Affordable Care Act and forced the president essentially to rely on only Democratic votes for the passage of the act, they could have influenced the legislation more. They could have gotten it to a model more like the what was seen then as bipartisan Wyden-Bennett program, which had fewer of these individual mandates to purchase health insurance, but did include these state-based insurance exchanges that are now in the process of being set up. They might have been able to get it closer to a little bit closer to something they wanted if they had said, hey, we might be able to deliver 5, 10, 15 votes in the Senate, 10, 20, 30 votes in the House. But because there was no Republican support for this, Democrats got what they could get with only Democratic votes, and they moved forward. It was a big blow to Republicans when the Supreme Court last year found that the law was constitutional, but I ultimately don't think that is going to be the make or break for the law. I think, as you said, Kathleen, it's the implementation of what happened
right.
in 2014.
And before we move on to other topics, to Diane's point that insurance executives are making huge salaries, I mean, it's not the only problem with the cost of health care. There are all kinds of problems, as the article pointed out. Do you imagine that we're ever going to have a really thorough examination of why in the world we spend in this country so much money on health care and way, way, way more money than other countries that are pretty sophisticated spend? Is anybody going to look at that? Is Congress, should they look at that?
Oh, I think Congress should look at that, and if it doesn't happen in the near term, then it will happen in the longer term because someone will have to, right? This will at some point become less of an ideological issue and more of a giant math problem. We want our overall share of GDP, the costs of healthcare, to be a lot closer to 10, 12, 15% and not 20, 23, 25% of our GDP. Otherwise, it's hard to make the math work in terms of the amount of money that the federal government brings in versus what it is spending on Medicaid, Medicare, et cetera. Why a given procedure, why a CAT scan or a blood draw costs so much more here than it does, say, in some European countries? I'm not a healthcare expert, but it partly falls back to this ideological view of who should be paying for it. It partly falls back to the fact that we have a system that is based on this employer mandate that came in the Nixon era, and part of it comes on the fact that frankly, and I'm not saying this is a bad thing, doctors make a lot of money, and hospitals make a lot of money. When you have these things as for-profit enterprises, it's a very tricky balance, Kathleen, in terms of how to keep the cost down. The Affordable Care Act made a point of saying that insurance companies could not 85%, excuse me, of the cost of any given medical procedure had to be the actual cost and not profit. The problem is, though, is that all you have to do to make more profit is raise the cost, and then you can also raise the percent that's profit.
Yeah.
And And that's a loophole that's not been addressed by this law.
We have lines open right now. Our guest for All Things Political this June 3rd is David Zwerdlich. He covers national politics for The Root. It's a part of the Washington Post Digital. And he's been with us before. We have covered a lot of territory. There's more to come. And you can join the conversation. Our phone number is 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. The email is talk@wpr.org. And our Facebook page is The Kathleen Dunn Show. You can always leave messages for us on that site as well. We have lines open. Bring us into new territory if you'd like. Just a reminder that tomorrow at 9, we will look at this healthcare story. And we are hearing from you during this hour that student loans are very much on your minds. And we will accordingly plan a show on student loans and what could happen in a month unless Congress takes action. That show will be forthcoming. More phone calls momentarily. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Hour two of our program today, we're going to be talking about the musical legacy of Carole King. You're probably aware she won the Library of Congress Gershwin Prize for Popular Song and was honored at the White House late in May. She is the first woman to receive that prize. And when you look at the songs that she wrote that were hits for other performers and then the songs that she wrote, it was really a breakthrough album for her in 71, I think, Tapestry, her album, which was way on top of the charts for a long time. Our guest to talk about her music, and we'll listen to some as well, Joel Whitburn, music historian, founder of Record Research, and author of the Top Pop Singles book series. Our guest this hour, David Zwerdlich, covers national politics for The Root, part of the Washington Post Digital. Here's an email that's come to us, David, from Jane. I watched some of Eric Holder's testimony in front of Congress on C-SPAN. He was treated with such disrespect by Republicans, especially Daryl Issa, that I had to turn it off. Thank you.
Well, you know, I think that, Kathleen, I'm sorry.
Okay.
There is an element of this, right, where there is clearly a politicization of Holder by ISA, by the committee that he chairs, by some Republicans on Capitol Hill, where, you know, Holder is seen by them as a sort of a nice, easy, soft target in the Obama administration where they can sort of heap controversy after controversy, put the screws to him, and try and make the Obama administration look bad. There's no question that there's some of that in this. I think that members of Congress take an oath to uphold the Constitution just like the Attorney General does. And so to the extent that some of these things are overblown or trumped up, they're not doing their job either, right? There's with a lot of controversy in right-wing circles over the quote-unquote Fast and Furious scandal where the Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, and Firearms under the Justice Department was supposedly had botched this gun running operation across the border of Mexico, and you know, there were the bureaucratic details were murky, but Republicans tried to pin this on Holder as if Holder had personally decided it was a good idea to let a bunch of guns loose across the border. Well, finally a big expose came out last year in Fortune magazine and debunked a lot of that and took the air out of a lot of that. Well, what did Republicans do? They just kind of moved on to the next quote-unquote scandal. And I think that doesn't reflect well on them. There's the people's business is there to be done in terms of the budget, in terms of these healthcare issues, student loan issues, the foreign affairs issues that we've been talking about. And these really are not the priorities that people voted for the president for or for the congressman. That being said, Kathleen, when the Attorney General is kind of called on the carpet on some of these issues, like the Fox News leak investigation, he really has to be forthright and just say, hey, look, these were the considerations and this is what we did. My view of the Fox News, in case any of your listeners by now aren't familiar with it, the Holder signed off on this request to tap the phones and trace the whereabouts of Fox News reporter James Rosen. He had a source inside the State Department.
who was leaking confidential information about North Korea. Well, if, in fact, there was such a heightened national security concern that they had no choice but to do this, then Holder should just say so, right? And if, in fact, there was another way to pursue this leak investigation, then perhaps they shouldn't have been so aggressive, since they actually named Rosen as a potential co-conspirator, even though he was ultimately not prosecuted. And Holder has to realize, I think, no matter whether he's being disrespected or not, that he serves at the pleasure of the president, and this is dealing with this stuff is maybe sadly part of his job. I think there's more chapters to be turned in this story.
Mm-hmm. Oh, I'm sure you're right on that one. Let's talk about guns for just a moment, where the shift seems to have gone from Washington to various states where Michael Bloomberg thinks he can make a difference. He evidently is funding grassroots groups who are lobbying local officials to enact stricter gun legislation in various states. Is that the direction that gun safety will be heading right now? Is it an issue that just can't go anywhere in Washington? And do you think that Bloomberg will be effective?
I think Bloomberg will be effective if he keeps it up once he leaves office as mayor of New York. If he continues, I think he's in his third and last term, if he continues either to run for higher office or if he pursues this just as a personal crusade, since he has the financial wherewithal as a billionaire to pursue it, I think he can be effective, but it is going to be and he seems sincere about it, but it will be a long, slow process. Two things for your listeners to keep in mind, Kathleen. One is that, and I'm shifting it away from Bloomberg for a second.
Sure.
One is that even though President Obama now is pursuing vigorously gun control legislation, the reality is that before the Newtown massacre, this was not part of the Obama agenda.
Right.
Obama had deliberately sort of laid this issue to the side, perhaps for future presidents to tackle. He was taking on a lot of things, and this just simply wasn't one of them. Once Newtown came along, the White House felt like they had to act on this issue. But it's a new part of the agenda. This wasn't part of the first term agenda. The second thing for your listeners to remember, and I know they know this, is that, you know, and I may have said this on your show before, Kathleen, is that this is one of those intractable issues where the left has just not been able to get around the right on gun control. In the same way, I think, that the right now has really nothing left to do on the issue of gay rights, right? Gay rights is a social issue which the right has all but conceded.
Mm-hmm.
It's for conservatives, for social conservatives, gay marriage and gay rights is a lost cause. Gay marriage is going to happen. It's not a matter of if, it's a matter of when. By that same token, for the left, gun control is the one social issue where the left simply has not been able to make any progress, put a dent in the right's dominance on the issue. And I think that incremental progress will be made for people favoring more gun control, but it is going to be a long slog, because the reality is that Americans, in comparison to other cultures, do favor the private ownership of firearms. There's no question about that.
Yeah. Let's go to more phone calls. Dagmar is next in Madison. Hi, Dagmar.
Yeah, you know, we could easily give a bottom line safety net for every American with health insurance. A man in California who needed a new hip was supposed to cost $120,000. So he went to Mexico, where an American orthopedic surgeon gave him a new hip for $13,000. He said malpractice insurance in Mexico was only 10%, and my brother in Germany, they only pay a few hundred dollars a year in malpractice insurance. Howard Dean once said that he and his wife are both doctors, and unless we do something about these gigantic malpractice insurance rates, he said that we will never be able to give adequate health care to American citizens. He said at this point it costs about $13,000 for every person to get health insurance. And one quick macabre joke, you know, in prisons, people have total health insurance, and somebody who's about to lose their house because they dare to have a severe illness, I joked, if you just throw a brick through a precious window and go to prison for 1 year, you will get the health, you will get for free what would make you lose your house if you're not in prison.
Mm-hmm. It's just another piece. There are so many pieces to this problem, and that could be another one. We could go on and on, David, couldn't we, with what makes the cost so high?
Yeah, no, absolutely. I was... You know, I'm not as familiar with the situation in Germany, but I will say that, again, it's that comparison of there is definitely a divide between the way, even though all the European countries have slightly different systems, there's a divide between the way this is done in Europe and the way it's done here. And it, at a minimum, the public is becoming aware of what could be seen as the inflationary cost of a lot of medical treatment here with relative to Europe. That was the case that the president sort of tried to make back in 2009, that whole, everybody remembers the phrase, bending the cost curve. That was the whole idea. He wasn't talking about the cost of individual procedures as much as he was talking about this idea of bending the cost curve so that the total share of our gross domestic product that we spend on healthcare gradually became reduced. Everybody remembers that phrase. Where the White House kind of came up short was that they didn't quite sell the public on how the cost curve was going to be bent. And we're still in the process of figuring that out. And I'm anxious to hear what you come up with on your show tomorrow, because I do think this is a topic that, I mean, this is a topic that affects everybody. So
it sure does.
Even people who don't follow politics closely care about this issue.
Yeah, Dagmar, thanks. Jim in Madison, hi.
Hey, how you doing?
All right, how are you?
I'm doing all right. Every time I listen to this show, I love the show. I listen every day, pretty much. But the all things political part just gets me every time, because I see politicians as more being a friendly group of corporate people getting together for fun time and seeing how much they can enjoy with our money. I mean, you have a guy from Monsanto who is now the head of the agriculture. You have a guy from Monsanto, a lawyer from Monsanto, who is now in the Supreme Court. Monsanto is pretty much banned all over, you know, several nations from using their genetically modified stuff, but it seems to be great and fine to use here. And then you got the banksters who are now in control of the Fed money system. I mean, they messed up one thing, and then they got put in control of it again to try and make it better, and it still is not getting better for us. The general average American human. I don't understand why no one makes any beef of this. I mean, they say something, but it's, of course, cut off by someone who says, oh, you're just a conspiracy theorist.
David, would you like to respond?
Well, I don't think you're a conspiracy theorist at all. I think you make a great point that we have a two-party system, for better or worse, and I think it's probably fair to say that the two parties represent somewhat of a narrow range of the political spectrum, right? When people commonly say Democrats or progressives or left, but those are different things, right? You can be far more progressive than the Democratic Party, just like you can be far more conservative than what people think of as the mainstream of the Republican Party. Both parties are establishment parties. Both parties contain establishment politicians. I confess I'm not as familiar with the Monsanto issue that your caller was referring to, but I think the general point very clearly stands. Look, President Obama, starting with him and talking about all Democrats and all Republicans, is a middle-of-the-road mainstream politician, and I think we're finally getting to the point as an electorate where people are starting to come around to this idea that, hey, this guy is not some wholly other person and leader just because he is a relatively younger guy who comes from a multi-faith, multi-racial background who grew up overseas. No, he's a politician, a mainstream politician, and he does what mainstream politicians do. And a lot of that is generating, trying to do stuff on behalf of citizenry, but also doing things on behalf of the corporate sector, because that's you know, frankly, how our system works. One thing that, despite a lot of bad news that's out there, right, part of what keeps President Obama going and in good standing with a lot of segments of the public is that the stock market is 2.5
exactly
times what it was
right
when he took office.
Right.
And because the corporate sector likes that, and because most Americans have 401ks or savings or stocks,
that keeps people, you know, relatively happy on that scale, even if there's a lot of other bad economic news in terms of, you know, unemployment or student loan rates, et cetera. That's the realities of it.
Yeah. David, thank you so much for being with us. It was a most informative and, I might add, entertaining hour.
Great. Thanks,
Kathleen. Thanks, David. David Zwerdlich covers national politics for TheRoot.com, part of the Washington Post. We had tons of phone calls on health care. I'm sorry we had to leave you, but please be reminded that tomorrow at 9, we're going to look at that major New York Times story, which I think is worth everybody's attention, and we'll talk about it tomorrow at 9. And just one more reminder that Olympia Snowe, for those of you who like politics, she was in the U.S. Congress and a senator for a number of years, a moderate Republican who's written a book, Fighting for Common Ground, How We Can Fix the Stalemate in Congress. Thanks to Rhonda Fanning for producing the hour, and thanks to Rhonda as well for on-air production. Please stay with us. The Legacy of Carole King is coming up.